Block, Season 5 of the Telly Award-winning podcast. Coming at you like friends L, Bunny, Bobby, James, Chico, Randy, and Mark, better known collectively as DeBarge. Feeling the beat of the rhythm of the night. Dance until the morning light. Forget about the worries on your mind. You can leave them all behind. I am Ryland Grant, screenwriter, Ringo Award-winning creator of fine comics like Aberrant, Bad Jacks, and The Jump. The other voice in the dark, the man in the box to the left is...
David Avalone, writer and someone who lived through DeBarge and has literally no memory of DeBarge.
So the entire Rhythm of the Night video is smack dab in the middle of The Last Dragon. Like the entire video. Ah. Not just a piece of it. Like Fair. The entire 3.5 minute fit is right in the middle of it. Vanity plays this, this VJ person, and it was produced by Barry Gordy. It was a Motown production.
DeBarge, I remember that.
Was kind of the Motown flavor of the month, sure. And it's just right in there. So had a lasting impact on me. Let's forget about the worries on our mind, David. Let's leave those all behind. And let's get into it. We have a great guest today. Very excited about it. An old friend, who I haven't, chatted it up with in a while. So I'm looking forward to getting into that, but, let us know what you have to pimp before then.
Well, the day this goes out, Drawing Blood number 5 should be on the stands in your local comic shop. And of course, available digitally. That's the 5th issue of the Image comic that I co-created with Kevin Eastman. 5 is a good place to jump in. It starts a whole new arc where our hero goes to visit the set of the gritty reboot of his 1990s gritty kids comic book. That complicated enough? Anyway, it's a good clean fun as our hero comes to Hollywood. What you got going on?
A couple of things. So, my film Haunted Heart, known as Isla Perdida in Spain, premiered a week and a half ago now. In Spain, has been received really well, is cruising along. It was announced as we record this a day or two ago. I believe it will be in theaters in the United States and on certain streaming platforms in North America at the end of September. So more info coming on that, but you will get to see it. It's cool. A damn good movie. Matt Dillon, Academy Award winning director, Fernando Treba. You're going to love it. Go see it. And as this airs, it should be that the Kickstarter pre-launch page for my next little ditty. It is a Black Mirror-esque sci-fi joint. Not outside the realm of The Jump. Called The Breach. Is now live, the pre-launch page. So go ahead and go over to Kickstarter, check out my socials for a link. You can head on over to Kickstarter and follow that. And that should launch September 16th. Nice. It'll be live. So get on board for that. It's going to be a great ride. It's a good book. I dig it. Fabio Alves, Ringo Award nominated artist on The Jump and on Band Jacks. Good stuff. Yeah. Nice. Go check that out, but let's stop yapping. Let's bring Julie in and
let's bring in Julie Speziani.
Hey everyone. How you doing?
Hey, howdy, Julie, howdy. Welcome.
Good to see you.
Tell the kids at home a little bit about yourself.
So I'm a comics creator. I've written and self-published indie comics. I've also written screenplays and TV pilots, but no IMDb credits for that yet. I do have a graphic novel coming out next month, mid-September, called Thanks, Romina, coming out through Chispa Comics.
Very nice. I was reading up on Thanks, Romina a little bit, and is there at all an autobiographical element in that comic for you?
There is, but obviously a lot of the events are embellished, all creative license, and nothing too much like real life. It was more, I think, a starting off point from my perspective when I left South Florida after college. I went to LA try to make it there. I spent 20 years there, but like I thought that was a good starting off point for a comic, because I feel like everyone's known the first time you've been at a real job, and it's almost like being a freshman in high school. You don't know what you're doing. You feel very out of place. You're learning the ropes. You're learning a new city. You're just kind of like very green. And mm-hmm. I felt like that was a really good basis, but also Romina, you get to see what she's thinking. So you're reading like her word balloons of like what her thoughts are on every given situation. So that's like the element of comics. You get to see the other perspective, not just the action, but also what they're thinking.
Sure. Sure.
Yeah. It's one of my favorite thing about comics is just immediately put you right into somebody's head. You know, yeah. and stay there. You know, and you can do it in books a little bit. It's harder to do in fiction these days. You know, publishers, editors, agents, they scoff a little bit at first person stuff.
I love first person. Yeah. It's my favorite form of writing, and I do it all the time. Yeah. And it's not, you know, there's the fallacy that if you're writing in first person, it's you, and it's definitely not you every time you do it. I think Vladimir Nabokov would particularly chafe at the idea that when you're writing in first person, you're writing you. I love it. I think and I love the unreliable narrator trope. And in comics, you can really do a great unreliable narrator stuff because you can show what's really going on and have word balloons, thought balloons that are saying the opposite of what the audience is seeing, which is always great.
Yeah, yeah.
Go ahead.
Before we go on, I do want to give a shout out to the artist S.E. Case, who illustrated Thanks Romina. Without them, this wouldn't have been possible. They did both pencil art, like lettering, everything, coloring. Wow. So yeah, it was amazing when we got on this project together. I definitely wanted not just her input, but her talent, because she is able to convey subtle like emotions through her characters and her mm-hmm. character faces. And so to me, I was just like, that's exactly what this story needs.
Yeah. And not, you know, that is a much sought after ability in comic.
Yeah.
Eastman always calls it acting.
Yeah.
You need an artist that can do the acting. You know, some of them are great cinematographers and they can't act, and you really need an artist who can act on the page. And as an aside, how did you find her?
So I actually, back in the day when Twitter was like comics Twitter, where everyone was able to like network and just promote and just, like start building relationships, you know, back in the day. So I don't know how the stars aligned. I just so happened to be like looking on Twitter, and I came across, I guess, we had mutuals, but they had a webcomic coming out, or a webcomic that they were working on. And I saw the webcomic, clicked on the link, read it, and I was just like, great. Not only do they hit a deadline, because a webcomic, you have to
write
deadlines.
That's a good point.
But also, I just love the nuances of the characters, like kind of like those conversations between those like intimate conversations between characters. I really liked that. And so I approached them and I was just like, look, are you game for this? Are you just, because I was just working on the first 10 pages, because I was working on my pitch. I wasn't even working on the series yet. I was just like, I can only afford you for like 10 pages. Can you do it? Mm-hmm. And she was like, yeah, you know, she was game.
That's great. Yeah. And that's, you know, I have definitely found artists on Twitter. It was great for that. I think it, you know, within reason, it still can be. It's just a lot more work than it used to be. I have, as an aside, found a nice comics community on Blue Sky. Of all of the Twitter knockoffs, that's the one that like models what's best in Twitter.
Yeah.
Without having yet all of the things that make Twitter unbearable. you know, over in that Nazi bar. I will say the one time that I found an artist, because the community is so incredibly small, I looked at the visible women hashtag on Twitter and found an artist I thought would be perfect for this thing that I needed called GTFO girl. And reached out to her and she was very interested in it. And then I mentioned it to Ben Bishop, our regular series artist. And he's like, dude, you know her. You sat at a dinner table with her at Albuquerque Comic Con. And I was like, right. That was a huge table. And she was at the other end of the table. But I did hear, this is Skylar, and wave and say, hi, nice to meet you. And neither of us remembered that until we were reminded just how small it is. And that's it's a fraught thing to reach out to an artist you don't know. But I love that you highlighted can hit a deadline thing.
Yeah.
Because that is the ultimate gray area. You know, there's the important things in having a collaborator is, can they literally do the work well? Talent.
Yeah.
Two is, are they a good person? And three, and it's the one that you can't tell in advance, is professionalism. And especially when you're dealing with artists who have never worked for a publisher, never hit a actual monthly comic deadline.
Yeah.
A lot of people who think they want to be comic book artists, when you get them into a situation where they have to draw 20 finished pages a month, they're like, no, man, I don't actually want that at all. That is not at all what I thought.
Even the good experienced ones, you know, I mean, I needed covers on The Breach and, you know, decided, okay, well, you know, I don't want all Fabio covers this go around. Let me bring some new talent in and went to people that are good and well known and, you know, have done work for friends and whatnot. It sort of, you know, with two of them, it was drawn out for so long that I just had to, you know, cut bait. And, you know, it was messaging with one of them today. And, you know, he finally turns up, you know, a month and a half later. And it's like, hey, I think I can do this. I think I can fit this in between this, that, and the other thing. And it's like, well, you know, thanks, man. But you know, the campaign will be about halfway through the campaign by then. I don't think that's going to work. But but yeah, it is so rare. I mean, what I liked about what Julie was talking about was, you know, there's a lot of good art out there, right?
Yeah.
I have plenty of people that can draw, and you know, of course, you want somebody that's going to deliver on time, that's professional, and all that stuff. But it's like when you can look and say, this is what's unique, you know, this is the thing. I mean, I remember my letterer HDE who I love and he was nominated for a Ringo for his work on Banjax. And, you know, I was looking at a couple of letterers and there are great letterers out there and, you know, three or four letters that I love. But with him, I was doing these really edgy, visceral fight scenes. Right.
Yeah.
And you had to be able to feel the fight scenes and the bones cracking and all of that stuff. And there was a lot of that in the art, but not nearly as much as we ended up with in the end, because a letterer was able to come in and just with, you know, I gave him a lot of latitude on the sound effects. A lot of times I wouldn't write the sound effect. I would say bones break or whatever. And he would come in and he would invent the sound in his head. He would color it.
That's such a talent, by the way.
it was. And I was reading through his pages and I'm just like, this guy can do this. You know, he wasn't, you know, I was reading other stuff. So he wasn't doing what I was asking him to do, but he was so bringing other things to life just with words on the page that I was like, I know he can do this. And he did it. I mean, it just blew all my expectations out of the water. And so, so that's great, you know, and it's like, you were working with there's an artist and then there's a true artist that is going to there's the artist that's going to come in and just kind of draw what's there. And then there's the artist that's going to come in and just fully elevate this thing in a way that you didn't even expect. And that's awesome. That's when you get something great, right?
Yeah. I mean, we definitely want to work together again. And depending on how well this first book does, I hope there's a volume two. I mean, in my mind, there's already a volume two because I'm already like writing it or I've already outlined it. But whether or not this does well enough where they're like, okay, let's get volume two going, then I'm all game.
No, that is of course always the trick. But I'm not surprised that you have more prepared going forward, because that's just the natural, you know, if you're a writer, it's very rare that sometimes you finish something and go, okay, I'm done with these characters, but this doesn't sound like that kind of story.
Yeah.
A lot of times you just go, no, I can write these. I can write these people for a very long time. You know, I think about the Hernandez brothers and, you know, Jamie's been writing Maggie and Hopi for 40 years. And it's great. It's they're still great comics. They're as great as they were in the 80s, you know, because they care and they've got humanity and empathy and all those things. I'd like to get down to the origin story. Are you from Florida originally?
So, yeah, I was born and raised in Miami. Went to college there. And then after college, packed up my car as much as I could. And then my friend and I were like, let's road trip to California. And then I just made our way through, you know, going through New Orleans, pre-Katrina, you know, Grand Canyon, and then finally landing in L.A. And the only basis I had of anything L.A. was movies. Like, just like, oh, there's Olympic, you know, like, you know, and Clueless when they were mentioning about living below Olympic or whatever. It was just kind of like, and I landed, by the way, in Hollywood on a Saturday night. Oof. And I was just like trying to navigate the crazy freeways that I was just like, wait, is it north? But it says it's going west. And
oh, that is the absolute worst. Most freeways in LA travel in a northwestern or southeastern direction.
Right.
And have to be labeled one. Like, they don't do 101 northeast. It's like, no, it's north. You're like, well, that's really west. But okay. That's really I'm headed due west. Somehow I see the setting sun directly in front of me and the sign says I'm headed north.
Right. So, and when we arrived, of course, this was, I feel like I'm dating myself. This was before, like, I had MapQuest, but you would have to be at a laptop to actually.
Right.
Yeah.
So,
you were printing out MapQuest generally.
And so my friend, we had to take the Thomas Guide because I'm like.
Thomas Guide.
To find like an apartment or sublet. She was like, oh, we're going on down Los Angeles Street. I'm like, okay. And she's like, oh, wait, I mean Los Angeles Avenue. I'm like, okay, is that a different part of town? Like, there are like so many different. It was insane. And for me, like, you know, coming from Miami, I know it's a big city, but it's. Everything is based on a grid. So to me, I knew where I was going in Miami, but in LA, I was just like, what does that mean? Like, why are we going through an overpass, but why can't we get through there? And it was great seeing all the cities that I, or all the buildings that I was used to watching on, you know, a movie, like in real life, because I'm like, it's so much smaller.
Just like the actors.
Yeah.
And were you coming out here to work in movies and television? Was that the plan?
Yeah, I wanted to, because I got my degree in television production, but I really wanted to become a screenwriter. I was, you know, very influenced by Charlie Kaufman. And I kind of was like, I really want to go out there. And obviously you could write anywhere, but there's something said to be, you know, in the midst of that industry and just making contacts and kind of be thrown like in the weeds with somebody and just building your network from there. And I really wanted to, you know, meet people and have that kind of like college experience that I didn't have like in Miami. I was just like, you know, finding my first job and all these other people, they're also like actors and writers or musicians. They're all doing, you know, the grunt work. They're all trying to pay bills, but they also have a dream. And that was also like another thing that I wanted to reference to like my comic is that, you know, everyone has a dream, but you still have to pay off your student loans.
Yeah.
You still have to do the adulting, but like you're doing double shifts, but if you're in a creative space, even if you're just working, but you know, other people, once they clock out, they're going to their gig or they're going to, you know, shoot their movie on the weekend. You'd be like, yeah, let me like join up. I feel like that's very like, it's very much like the film 101 that I didn't go, because I didn't go to film school. Like that's something that I was definitely craving. And that's what I kind of immersed myself into when I was in my mid-20s.
Yeah. I always think it's a weird form of snobbery when people are like, oh, every waiter in Los Angeles is a writer or an actor. I'm like, yes, how dare they dream above their station?
Yeah.
I prefer waiters who know their place and have no ideas about humanity that they'd like to express elsewhere. It's like, fuck you.
I
can have a much more interesting conversation with a waiter who's an actor or writer. And look, there are plenty of them that are annoying wannabes that are never going to get anywhere. And that's true
everywhere.
Those people are in every major city in America and the world, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, here's the thing. How many lawyers do we know that like do comic books on the yeah. side. You know, they come home and how many,
well,
you
know, one.
The number of lawyers that have like tried to slip me their specs, you know, their spec screenplay or whatever. It's like, you know, it's not a, you know, it's everybody. I mean, my best friend from high school is, has a great, you know, makes six figures a year, as like an IT coordinator. And he writes screenplays on the weekends, you know, it's just, I don't think it applies to just the waiter anymore.
I always kid about people are like, wow, that I had a real estate agent today and she was the most gorgeous. I'm like, yeah, they're all actresses.
Yeah.
They're all.
Yeah,
like,
yeah. Every single one of them.
Everyone who was the most beautiful girl in
her
high
school. Everyone has a headshot.
is out here doing real estate right now. And so you're going to be shocked that like you get pulled over by a cop and you're like, wow, that guy looks like a friggin' movie star. It's like, yes, because he is.
like he was
the prettiest boy in his high school. He came to LA. He couldn't get work. Now he's writing speeding tickets. That's, you know, so of course he looks like Rock Hudson. Like,
and he works 3 days a week and then he goes to acting workshops and auditions during the other 4 days. That's what happens. Walk into a firehouse, same thing, you know?
Yeah.
But it's always all the time.
It's always funny. But you know, I myself am someone who worked in film for 30 years before deciding to try comic books. Were comic books always part of the matrix of your interests creatively, or when did that enter your vision?
So I've always been interested in comics. Like my best friend from grade school, like she would read comics, but and I actually worked at a bookstore right before I left Miami. My orders manager was like the first person I told that I was moving to LA. And I said, I'm giving my 2 weeks because I'm moving to LA. She's like, oh, really? But yeah, I mean, I was always curious about comics, but it's so daunting to go into like, let's say a comic book shop. You'd be like, oh, this looks interesting. Oh, this is number six. Where are the first five chapters? You know,
number 375 if you're talking about Batman or Spider-Man or the X-Men or whatever.
And it's just, it's a bit of a gauntlet for a lot of like people who are just interested and they want to delve into it. And really, like, I didn't get into like even thinking about writing comics until I was dating now my husband, Rob Harrington, who is also at one point a comics book creator. He also wrote comics for, I'm going to steal from Dave Dwanch, the Voldemort, you know.
Yeah, we had the Voldemort episode. Yeah, Dave and I chopped that up pretty good.
I saw that and I was just like, but yeah. When we were just first dating, my husband, Rob, when he started to get to know me more, he was just like, you know, what are your interests? And once he started like tapping into like what I liked, he was, you know, recommending, oh, why don't you read this? Oh, you know, if you like this, maybe you like that. And so from there, I was able to like read Why the Last Man, which I gobbled up the whole entire series, like back to back to back, because at that point, Brian K. Vaughan just finished the last trade. So I was reading the whole series front to back. And this was during when I was working on a TV show. So on my lunch break, I would be reading comics and people would be like, hey, you know, this is pretty cool. Do you like comics? I'm like, yeah, I like it.
What was the TV show?
So this was called Brothers and Sisters. Uh-huh. So I was on the ABC lot. And so Sally Field, like, she was.
And what was your job on it?
So I worked in the production office, but in the accounting section. So I was an accounting clerk, and the writer's room, I was like on the third floor, but they were on the second floor. And I know this because, you know, obviously me trying to become more of a screenwriter, TV writer, I wanted to pass by and try to not schmooze, but, you know, just to introduce myself. But it's so incredibly difficult because like the writer's room is like so coveted. Those positions are so coveted that, yeah, of course, anyone talking to anyone there, they're going to be kind of kissing your ass. And I'm not a sycophant. So it was really hard for me to like schmooze and do like small talk. Like I can't do that very well. So but I worked on it for a few seasons and then, went to the next job.
And then what was the transition to actually writing comics and wanting to create comics?
So when I started to read more comics, got more like confident, like going to like comic book stores and, you know, having a pull list and everything, I actually stumbled upon like a comic book writing course, Jim Higgins.
Oh, Jim.
Yeah. So
Jim's been on the show.
Yeah. Way him. Back when it was at Meltdown, we would have mm-hmm. Meltdown University, and it was during the time when, you know, there were like a lot of stand-up comics would come in at night and do their bits at the end at an open mic. And we would have our actual class right there in Meltdown over in the back. And it was just maybe 6-7 people max. Mm-hmm. And we're all just trying to create comics. So my first one, By the Slice, was made because of that class.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great. And what the... So you wrote it in class or
yeah.
Mm-hmm. And how long was it? What was the shape of the piece?
So it was more of a zine style because since I was the one writing it, I didn't have all the artists there were already working on their stuff. I went and I think back in the day it was like DeviantArt, and I just happened to stumble upon Cecilia Latella's like art. It was all watercolors, but she had such a great, again, it was the faces that her characters took on, it was just so great to see, like, you know, the comedy aspects, the serious aspects. And so I wanted to use that for By the Slice. And I approached her and told her, you know, this is what I was thinking. It was only like 12 pages. But yeah, she did it black and white, you know, just inks. And then I printed it out and then I sold it. I think I only have like one copy left. But yeah, it was actually was being sold at Meltdown. It was pretty cool. Interesting thing.
Yeah, Julie and I met because of the Meltdown thing. I mean,
that was my guess.
Yeah, long time listeners will remember that. I started my career in the back of Meltdown Comics, and have a special place in my heart for anybody that that was there. But both Aberrant and Banjax were developed in the back of Meltdown. You know, with Jim Higgins, and that's why I'm close with Steve Prince and Carla Nappi and, you know, a bunch of other people that were there. But, yeah, Julie and I met because when Meltdown closed, I planned this this event called Made at Meltdown, where I brought together 30 creators who had created books in the back of Meltdown, and Julie was one of them. And we had this, you know, we had this big event, and, you know, I had podcasts down there, and it was just a big party. It was a big eulogy, a funeral for our favorite comic shop. But
Meltdown is much missed. It was,
it what was is it definitely now?
At condos.
Oh. Yeah.
Building got raised, I mean,
it caught fire first.
Yeah. It was on Prime Sunset Boulevard.
Yeah.
Real estate, and it was a huge space. I mean, it used to be a quarter of that size across the street before it became the big complex. And I was actually, frankly, always amazed that it was open and in that location. We miss it. It was definitely, when I started my comics writing career, it was sort of the friendliest shop to me. And I would go in there and do the, you know, the standard author with new book out today photo and put it online and all that kind of thing. So you've got a comic that you've written and is in black and white and you self-printed.
Yeah.
Right. What's the next step? What's the next chain in the chain?
From there, I wanted to do more. And Rob, you know, once he started to see like how much I've been doing, you know, writing, like just writing everything, but also producing, he's like, let's self-publish. Let's, you know, let's use our day job money and, you know, actually commission artists to, you know, collaborate on our titles, you know, because this is great. This is not something that's like, oh, I have to wait for a whole industry or a committee to decide whether or not we're going to go forward with your idea or story. It's more like, okay, we're taking it by the reins ourselves and just making comics. And so I did a few titles. One was like a micro anthology that was like Wrangling Cats. I mean, we're talking about like working with different artists. I was working with international artists you know, stateside, you know, different time zones, you know, different. Yeah, everyone, I have a few letters here, a few colors there. And it was just like, okay, this is the perfect time to learn all this. But also, am I going to do this again? Probably not. But this was all good experience to use. But
sometimes knowing what you never want to do again is the most important thing to know.
Yes, because I was just going ragged. I was just like, it's only because it's a micro anthology. So there were only four stories, like 4 pages each, and it wasn't that big, but it was the fact that I had to work with a lot of people, a lot of different, you know, artists, not egos, but I mean, just the way they work, it was just almost like, and if they're international, then there's the language barrier too. But just learning to do that, and I was just like, okay, well, not only am I seeing my work realized, but you're also seeing how much you have to play like the manager when you're when you're editing your own stuff. So it's just, again, it's something that's invaluable. I feel like a lot of, because your podcast is mainly geared towards a lot of people who want to get into comics or, you know, create their own comics. I think that's really great to do for yourself, is just self-publish something your own, but, you know, do it in a way that you will learn along every step of the way, and then be like, I would rather just do this, because I hate promotions, but I have to promote all my self-published stuff because no one else is going to do it. There's no overhead for me to like buy someone's time, be like, hey, can you promote this for me? Thanks.
Yeah, I mean, in my experience, you know, even when you're dealing with a publisher, you got to do most of the promotion yourself also. So you're ever off the hook.
No, but I'm always a big believer, and I was the same way in film, which my incomprehensibly complicated IMDb page is the proof of. I think the more you know about the process of the art form you work in, the more you know about. I feel like I was a producer and a director and an editor and all of that in film, and I still am to some degree. But like, particularly being a producer and editor and director in the post-production process really prepared me for making comic books. Because basically, you know, the artist, you know, you're managing the cinematographer, and then you're managing, you know, colorist is the colorist. The letterer is the sound mix. You know, these are all things that I'm used to managing and being kind of precise with and all that. And I think it might be frustrating for you if you're not used to working with that kind of team and you're not familiar with, this is a lot of steps. And I also always say, anyone who has ever self-published will never go, comic books shouldn't be $3.99. That's ridiculously expensive. You go, no, that is the thinnest possible profit margin imaginable. You know, not to take the side of the publishers on anything, but I always say, like, self-publish and you will not be mad about how much comics cost. You will be amazed that they do not cost a lot more than they do.
Yeah. You know? I mean, you kind of have to, like, on the business side, and that's the other part where I had to develop, like, the business side of, like, going to conventions and then, you know, printing, you know, the stuff out. Like, I have yet to do a Kickstarter or any sort of crowdfunding, only because I've heard from all my friends who make comics, they're like, it's a second job. So you've got to be prepared, like, time-wise, but also you're going to have space, because if you have a palette of books, you got to put it somewhere. And obviously, back in California, coming from like a 400 square foot apartment, that was not going to cut it.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be able to fit anything.
Yeah. But if you have the room now, I would definitely recommend it. I mean, cause yes, it's a full-time job, but on the other hand, if you do it well, it pays a lot better than your full-time job. You know, if you wrangle it right, it can be a good thing, and it can be a colossal headache, and you have no control over who your fans are and what they're going to do and how they're going to feel about things and all of that. But by the same token, you create fans that have a buy-in in every sense of the world into the project, and they feel, you know, they feel proprietary about it, and they care about it. And that can be a very good thing.
It is a lot more doable than people who haven't done it think it is. And I just say that from experience, because Charlie Stickney tried to get me to do it for 2 years before I ever pulled the trigger on it. I was like, I don't want to do that. I don't want to mess with fulfillment. I don't want to do this. I don't want to do that. And Charlie was just like, trust me, trust me, trust me. And then, you know, pandemic comes and you know, there wasn't a regular comics business. And so I had to do something. And so I'm like, you know, and Charlie tapped me on the shoulder and said, hey, Kickstarter just told me that, that there are more backers there than ever. And there are fewer projects there than ever. So if you're ever going to do it, try it now.
Yeah.
I tried it and it was a, you know, it was a big deal success. And, you know, and it sucks a little bit to, you know, sit around on a Friday night and pack up comic books. But if you do it right, you know, you invite some friends over, have some pizza, some beer, turns into a party. It's very doable. And, it is a great way to fund your projects. And, you know, I put comic books in comic shops for a good long while, and it is very hard to make money putting books in comic shops. I have made $1.25, maybe a little bit more on Kickstarter, and the fan bases are very different. You know, there are people that pretty much exclusively buy their books on sites like Kickstarter, and there are people that pretty much exclusively buy their books in comic shops, and there is overlap, but not nearly as much as you think there is. And the bottom line is, like, if as a creator you are not servicing, you know, both audiences, you're really leaving some money and some exposure. You're leaving some experience on the table. And I'm in this place now where for various reasons. I am supposed to have 2 books in comic shops right now, but ugly twist and an ugly turn, and that's not the case right now.
Yeah.
But I am in this place where I need to now refresh my comic shop presence, and that is a bit overdue. But yeah, you know, I would encourage you to check it out. I think, you know, particularly if you can go on a Kickstarter and be like, hey, I am the woman who wrote these books that you are familiar with, that you've seen in your comic shops, that that, you know, Simon and Schuster is releasing now. It gives you a little cachet. You know, people are like, at the very least, it makes people look at the book. And if the book is of quality, they're probably going to back the book. And so, it's good. And man, it's a good community. You know, we release books in comic shops, and it can feel like you're shouting into the Grand Canyon sometimes, right? There's not a ton of feedback. Every once in a while you get hit on Twitter or something like that, and that's not always a positive thing. But with Kickstarter, it's like, you know, you are almost daily interacting with the people who are buying your book and read your book. And when you hit a home run, they let you know immediately. You do something wrong, they let you know immediately. Usually in a positive way. and you do kind of build the book together with these people, and it's a pretty wonderful experience. And, you know, it's hard. You keep your control.
Yeah.
You keep your rights. You make the book you want to make, and it does not, and then doing the Kickstarter thing does not preclude you from then going to a traditional publisher and saying, hey, this thing did pretty well over here. It's going to do pretty well in a comic shop too. And smart
publishers. I'm sure editors notice too. Yeah. When you start promoting your Kickstarter, then they're like, oh, let's check this out now.
Smart publishers know now that if it did well on Kickstarter, it's going to do well in a comic shop. You know, it's a proving ground now. They used to not see it that way, but they're, you know, these people aren't stupid, you know? A lot of those crossover success stories now. And so, I would recommend it. I would, if I were you, I would, you know, the next thing you're doing, take a long look at crowdfunding. And if you want to talk to somebody about it, hit me up, because it is worth it. And it is a message to everyone out there listening, creators and would-be creators, check out Kickstarter. It's a wonderful place.
I'll definitely consider it. I mean, I obviously have other titles that I want to work on. It's just kind of like setting up time, but also I know with crowdfunding, you have to have like a very planned schedule, because if you're kind of like not organized on your end, I know it's going to bite you in the ass later.
Oh, yeah. I mean, have the book done before you go.
With any other thing, I'm sure that when you moved into comics writing from movies and television, as I did, like, you do your homework, you know, you figure out what the market is, you figure out how do people do these things, what are the rules of these things. And the same applies to Kickstarter. I've seen some people launch campaigns where you just look at it and you go, you haven't thought about how this works at all, have you? Like, you launch your campaign at midnight on the West Coast. Who, no one's going to be making a last minute buy at the cash register a month from now,
right,
at midnight. Like, that's not when you end the campaign. That's, and you see that, I mean, ultimately you see that across the board, the number of people who don't understand the internet. I will do someone's podcast and they're lovely people and I love them. And then I see in my notifications on Twitter that they've just tweeted about it. And it's literally like 2 a.m. on a Saturday morning. And I'm like, do you understand that this never, this vanishes below the waves and never gets seen again by anyone except me, because you tagged me in it? I was like, how about I'll wait until noon tomorrow to retweet this so someone sees it? People just, they have weird object permanence problems with the internet.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I sent this. They feel like it's a text. Like, oh, I sent it to you at 3 a.m., but it, you'll see it at 9 when you wake up. It's like,
yeah, this is posted. It's just like, what?
Yeah, it's like, no, it's really, this isn't on a bulletin board somewhere that we all have to walk past. Like I said, you literally are throwing a bottle with a message rolled up inside it into the ocean. And it has, it has 5 minutes to bob to the surface next to a boat with people on it. And if it doesn't do that,
litter, by the way,
Facebook and Twitter, they do not want you to see anything. So do not make it, do not make it even a hair harder to see anything.
Yeah.
Because even under the best circumstances,
yeah,
people are not going to see your sales announcement, your release announcement, your whatever. Unless you're an attractive young woman dancing, nobody's going to see.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, no, using the word Kickstarter in a post on Facebook means that they will bury it. Like, that is a thing that literally happens. It's amazing.
Now you just give me an idea. I'm like, well, I know a few dancers. Maybe they could just
there
be behind
go.
Me and I'll be a comic and be like, hey. Click on the link.
Yeah, there you go.
It is, you know, it's funny, but it has worked. I have occasionally, like, when I had something to sell, here's a picture of my cat next to the comic book. It's like, it's a cat picture. You know, ultimately that will sell. And honestly, one of the comics I do is about cats. And I heard secondhand that when it was, you know, passed by, when the project was brought up to the then president of Kickstarter, he said, well, that's going to make $1 million because it's got a cat in it. Like, that, you know, like, doesn't even matter if it's good or bad. It's got a cat. So, having dancers for your comics TikTok is not a terrible idea.
That's true.
But what was the, I'm all, you know, I'm all always all about the road and the process. Mm-hmm. This book is being published by Chispa.
Chispa Comics. Chispa. It's a Latinx imprint from Scout Comics.
Okay.
And it's amazing. Again, back in the day with Comics Twitter, I just so happened to be, because at this point, I already had the pitch. I already had, you know, the outline. I already had all the materials except for the full first issue. And I wasn't getting any responses from the publishers. I was trying to get a literary agent. That didn't work either. So I just so happened to be on Twitter and I came across David Bowles, who's the editor-in-chief of Chispa. He was posting saying, you know, we opened up this imprint, you know, for Latinos, you know, go ahead and, you know, if you have something, you know, send it to me. And I was like, well, I'm Latina. I'm first generation American, you know, Peruvian, Italian. So I'll just go ahead and like send him what I have. And then he's like, perfect. This is great. You know,
what did you have at that time? Did you have finished pages or script?
Just the first 10 pages. And then like the script along with the rest of the pitch, because a lot of publishers, they have like different parameters of what they want in a pitch. Like sometimes it's just the outline. Sometimes it's just summary, character breakdowns, you know, full on arc. So I kind of gave him everything and I'd be like, look, this is what I'm thinking. And he was just like, love the art, love the story, you know, let's start talking, you know, more about contracts and everything. And then, that's how it came out. And then of course I have here, this is the first issue. This came out last summer. I actually traveled back to LA to do some signings there, Collector's Paradise comic book or Comic Bug, and a few other places, and they were so nice, everyone there.
Great. So it was, it, this is a collection of floppies then, the thing that's coming out on the 13th or on, yeah, September 13th, is that right?
17th. Yeah, September 17th. So funny enough, they wanted to do the model, and I understand that, like, instead of, you know, doing every single issue and then doing the trade, they put the first issue and then waited for the trade.
I've heard Charlie talk, Stickney talk about that, and I totally get it.
Yeah, because when you're buying like issue four, you're like, well, I already spent $20. I could have just spent $20 for the collected edition. So that's what we're doing this time. And it was great just to tell people, because a lot of my family, they don't go into comic book shops. So them, they were just like, I don't understand. I can't go to a bookstore for a comic. I'm like, no, Dad, sorry.
Big problem.
Yeah,
you can't go to a 7-Eleven or a gas station anymore for a comic either. Yeah. And how sad is that? But
and Scout's distribution deals with Simon and Schuster, so it's in Amazon,
right.
it's in Barnes and Noble, it's in, you know, all that stuff. So Mom and Dad and Aunt Jenny and whoever else, you know, and you know, wherever they are. The Have it shipped right to the house via Amazon, right? So yeah, that's good.
Yeah, that model cracks me up a little bit, because unless I'm afraid a comic is going to go out of print, I have absolutely done that thing where you buy the first issue and you go, this is great, and now I'll wait on the trade and buy it.
Right.
And it's funny that, you know, Scout has sort of decided, and I think it was Charlie that brought them that model when he was there, that like, no, well, if that's going to be how people buy comics, then that's what we're going to do. We're going to show you the pilot and then you buy the series box set.
Right.
And that's,
The biggest problem is attrition, right? I mean, in comics, it's, you know, if you sell 10,000 copies of issue one, you're going to sell 5,000 of issue two and 2,500 of issue three and on and on.
Yeah,
exactly. At some point it's not profitable anymore. And it makes perfect sense. And, you know, TV follows the same thing where it's like, if you, for the longest time, you can go on, you go on to Amazon and you can download the pilot episode of Miami Vice for free. Yeah. And you watch it, and if you like it and you want to start buying seasons, then, you know, they, whatever they cost you, $19.99 or something like that. It works, you know, it's a drug dealers have been doing it forever. First hit's free, right?
No, exactly. Show people a taste and then they're, you know, and also, you know, I always say, like, you having 10 pages of finished art, that's always the pilot that's going to work. Like, you know, a pitch is great, a script is great, but as much as we'd like to believe that everybody has vision and can read it and go, oh, this is going to be a great comic.
Yeah.
Even showing them one page of art, they go, oh, okay, I know what this comic book looks like. And now I will buy it. Now I will be interested in having it. You know, that's always when we brought Drawing Blood to Image, I think I had 7 completed issues to show them and scripts for, you know, 8 and 9. And they were like, great, can't wait to read them all. you know, and that there is that thing of having too much and people going, I actually don't like this. But if the work is strong, you know, you're going to have a much easier time making that sale or impressing an editor or a publisher if they see, oh no, this is the final thing actually looks like it's a real comic book. You know, that's the, you know.
I just love that we live in this time now where Scout Comics has a Latinx imprint. That's like, kind of amazing, you know? It was how many decades where it was 90% of our population walked into a comic shops and didn't see themselves, you know, represented in any meaningful way, you know? It was the odd cameo here or there. And now, you know, and now major publishers have these things. And what I love about it is, I don't know, you know, you can still walk into a comic shop and feel like the books you pick up are 80% the same. And what I love about these imprints, even if it's a, you know, again, we had we had Chris Longo on last week talking about, you know, he's launched this publishing company, and it's horror and sci-fi stuff, but it's like, but he is searching for the different stuff, you know, and yeah. So you get these things that. You don't normally see, and not just in terms of like what category does it go into, but right. I feel like this call for, you know, this call for submissions that you saw, it's like it's begging for personal stories, right? It's begging for stories about a cultural experience, I don't know, it's so weird because I feel like it's what. When I talk to really smart editors at really big publishers, that's what they want. They're like, oh, give me something personal. Give me something moving. Give me something, you know, and you wrote this story where it's like, it's not autobiographical necessarily, but it comes from this base of, it is built on this autobiographical foundation, right? Like yeah. you knew this situation, you knew this character, and then it kind of went from there. Right. But it's like, but I don't know. It just, I feel like it sets you up for success in such an interesting way. I mean, I say it all the time where it's like comics, it's going to cost you hundreds of hours, tens of thousands of dollars. In the end, it better be about something, right? Yeah. Don't just write nonsense.
Write what you think other people are going to like.
Oh yeah.
You could pick out yourself.
Put some of you in there, and there's a lot of way to do that. I mean, you can do your personal, you know, autobiographical stuff, but it's like, even, you know, again, Aberrant is a popcorn action movie in the end, but
right.
it is really this treatise on PTSD and losing people that are close to you and all of that stuff. And so some people can read it and they're just entertained and they're laughing and they're chuckling and they like the action. There is not a San Diego Comic-Con that goes by where I don't have a veteran come up to me with tears in his eyes saying, thank you for doing that. That was a really meaningful book. You got us. Like all of these themes of loss and PTSD, it really hit with me. Thank you for that. I made the book about something. Yeah, it's popcorn action and it's fun and it's, you know, but there's a lot of me in there and there's a lot of meaningful stuff in there. So if you're not doing that, if you're at home,
yeah.
And you're not doing that one way or another, then start over, try again.
Yeah.
Ultimately you're always bringing yourself into it, whether it's conscious or unconscious. It's just a question of how hard are you squashing that because you think no one wants to hear it, or how hard are you going, no, let me plumb the truth that I know. Let me tell about the world as I see it and as I understand it. You're always doing it. It's just a question of what that perspective is.
And I think going back to what you were saying about crowdsourcing or crowdfunding like sites, I mean, there's stuff that I've written and I've kind of pitched to publishers, but they've always come back with like, oh, we have something similar in the pipeline. I'm like, but similar in concept or similar in story, like what's similar, because there is not through my eyes, it's not what I'm putting on the page. There's always going to be that perspective that you're going to bring to it, because I mean, everyone has like a cabin in the woods horror movie, you know, that they could think of, but I only think of Evil Dead 2. So yeah. Being like the creme de la creme, you know, it's just one of those things where like you could take a concept and do it so many different ways and so many different viewpoints. Like, let's hear it from a unique voice. To me, so, I think that's
sometimes,
why.
Sometimes you have to do the book before people realize how good it's going to be. I mean, you're hitting on something that we talk about all the time, where it's like, with traditional publishers, you have to go to somebody, and usually it's a white guy in his 50s, and you have to ask for permission to make your book, right? And what suits them, you can fit on a postage stamp, right? So if you want to make your book, and you want to make your book your way, often you got to do it on your own, right? And Kickstarter's full of those books, and a lot of them are awesome, right? And a lot of them wouldn't have existed if... if they went to like the five companies you go to and waited for permission from said 50-year-old white guy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then they're just going to be like, well, why don't you do it this way or that way? And just kind of like, well, why would you give me that note? You know what I mean? It's just kind of like, it's always going to be different. Like in comics, you know, you're always going to get feedback. And I think that's great. We have a great editor. For like my pitch, I actually hired an editor and she's great editor. I gave her a shout out on the trade paperback saying thank you. Because she was one of my earliest like cheerleaders. And she said, I want Romina to live. So you know, this is what I think you should read in terms of like, you know, other books, other comps, but also I think this deserves a place in comics. And it's because of her that she, I was supposed to sign like, okay, that's the confidence I need. I just need like one person to be like, go for it. And then I hit the ground running. So yeah. Thank you, Rebecca Taylor.
you gotta, and it's people, it's funny the way people will fight their own best instincts. I won't even mention the project, but I had a meeting with a guy once and was a very competent TV showrunner, had worked on a bunch of great things. Pretty mainstream things. And I had a fairly dark pitch with a co-writer, and this guy in the meeting, he stressed to us that he wanted to get out of doing like mainstream network TV things. He wanted to do, you know, edgy, dark, R-rated streaming things. And the first thing he said about our main character is, can he be a divorced dad with who's taking care of a little boy, and maybe the boy has a dog? And I was like, that's the most mainstream network TV note you could possibly. I was like, no. So you want to work? Your pitch isn't he's a heroin addict who's in recovery.
Oh man,
your pitch is he's a divorced dad from some imaginary sitcom. You think this is. And it was just the funniest thing, because this guy's self-image versus who he was deep down as a creator.
Yeah.
His self-image was that he was a guy dressed all in black, drinking, you know, smoking clove cigarettes and drinking Campari in the back of the bar. And no, dad, dude, you're a suburban dad in chinos and it's okay.
Yeah.
Own it, but don't try to be with the existentialist kids in the bar, man. If your first note is, why can't he be a divorced dad with a teenage boy that he's having trouble raising? That was so outside. And without giving away, there was nothing in the pitch that was about parenthood.
Right.
It's like Spielberg making War of the Worlds, which is a very competently made film.
Yeah.
But it's an adaptation of a book about colonialism and imperialism and the shoe being on the other foot. And somehow Steven Spielberg and a really great screenwriter make it about being a divorced dad.
Like, wait, did that guy work on that show? On that movie?
No,
that would be really funny.
No. I think it's Evangelion or some other very, very Academy Award nominated dude. But it's just like, man, don't graft your problems with your dad onto War of the Worlds, for God's sake. Like, if you can do that to War of the Worlds, you will do it to anything. And please, I'm so glad he made The Fablemans, because it was like, thank you. Can we now maybe make something about a divorced dad? That would be so great. It's like
he did something about a divorced mom.
It's like in the 80s, I used to say about Werner Herzog, who I love.
Yeah.
But he did like 20 movies in a row about madmen that lead their followers to destruction. You know, and he's a German born of a certain age. I was like, just make the movie about Hitler, for God's sakes, man. Like, you know, stop finding analogs for him. Just make the Hitler movie. And he didn't, but he has moved on.
Get that out of your way, you know.
Yeah, but he has moved on to other subjects now than madmen who destroy their followers. But I was like, dude, you're trying to work something out and you still haven't looked directly at it. You know, just look directly at it, for God's sake, man. Anyway.
That asteroid documentary you just made was pretty good. Fireball. Highly recommended. Apple TV. Yeah.
Did that just come out?
It was out maybe about 2 years ago, but yeah, it's just I think because of the Chelyabinsk asteroid, the near miss, that just kind of refreshed it in everybody's mind, and so Werner decided to go out and he just started sniffing around the topic, and so it's all these kind of little bits and pieces about asteroids
and he's become so much more interesting. Dropped his singular obsession with that one topic.
Yeah.
And that's a good thing. but still, it is the, people can definitely oversell the idea of write what you know, but it's the thing, even if you're writing Star Wars, George is still writing about being a teenager in a small town that thinks the world is elsewhere and there's more interesting things that can happen to him elsewhere, and his love of hot rodding comes out in every one of those movies, whether it's the pod race or Han Solo in the asteroids or whatever. It's always driving a car really fast is what Star Wars is about, and that's charming to me. That's an interesting thing, is take it and go like, I can make American Graffiti, but now that I've made American Graffiti, I can channel the stuff that I can also make a science fiction movie about
Tatooine graffiti.
Exactly. I can apply my life experience to other things. And it's what you get, you do get the writers whose life experience is watching movies or reading comic books, and they make movies about movies and comic books about comic books. And those can be great, and those can be terrible, but it's good to have a life. I'm always in favor of having had a life and having interests outside of the thing that your main focus is on. It's always, I got fascinated by a science teacher in college. It ended up taking my college didn't have minors, but to the degree that it did, mine would have been in the history of science. I had absolutely no intention of that. That stuff has come back in almost everything I've written as a professional writer, just what I know about the history of the world and the history of different cosmologies. And long before Steve Martin wrote Picasso at the Pano Agile, what fascinated me about this guy is the first thing he said in the very first class was, "You've been sold." And he had that 1950s rocket scientist voice, which I love, the NASA guy voice. It's like, you've been sold a bill of goods your entire life. And that is that the arts are over here and the sciences are over here, and they're two completely different things. And he, again, before Steve Martin, he's like, you don't get Picasso without Einstein. You don't get, uncertainty theory without Dada, that the things don't happen at the same time by accident. That's what it is. That's the world we live in, is what scientists tell us how the world is working, is what we all digest, and we all end up writing about it, whether we think we're writing about it or not. And that was a life-changing thing to notice and to have my attention drawn to. All that to say, you write about your own life, you also write about the things you're interested in, and you can't help but writing autobiography.
Thanks Romina, there's a relationship between her and her sister that plays out, and it's just kind of like they're like complete opposites, like on the page. And I have four sisters, by the way. I come from a large family. I'm the youngest of eight. So yes, and I've yet to see Succession. I know it's on my to-do list. Since I have four sisters, obviously I couldn't help but use some of the innate knowledge of having an older sister, kind of like having that flesh out these characters and have those real life like conversations, and even like how different, even if you have the same parents, you're so different, you're your own person, but you're still connected in that way. And so I made it almost like, as much as I made it for Romina, I almost made it for like the family and the friends that she makes. Is almost like she's like so interconnected with everybody, and I feel like a lot of people would identify with that.
Sure. Yeah. It's also, interestingly, it's a it's a thing that writers struggle with a lot, I find, is you, the hardest thing to write is a well-populated universe. You watch so many TV shows and movies and you're like, this person has one friend. Like, they don't have another person they ever talk to. That's weird. That's a little weird.
Yeah.
And I get it. It's the less people on the call sheet, the easier. And it's hard to write the world as complex as it is. Mm-hmm. And to deal with the fact that someone you barely know can be the person who says the most significant thing anyone ever said to you. Yeah. Rather than it being your father or your boss or your work friend or whatever. But mm-hmm. struggling to write that real complexity is absolutely worth it.
Yeah. Hear, hear.
You know? But before we wrap up, are you working on anything now? I know you've got the book coming out on the 17th, but what is on your desk right now?
Oh, on my desk right now, a whole lot of post-it notes. That's sure. how I work. It's just post-it notes everywhere. Everyone uses index cards, but I use post-its and journals. But otherwise, I'm actually in the middle of writing a pilot. I belong to a writer's group. And so we meet monthly and we like review how much we've written. We try to do like a section at a time and just kind of like give each other notes. It's really great because it kind of keeps you on schedule. And so I'm trying to get like more stuff done, not just comic books, but other stuff as well, because, you know, I'm not a one trick pony. I don't feel like I'm only going to stick to my lane, whichever lane that mm-hmm. would be. I want to do everything, like, you know, writing more stories, but also writing outside of myself, like outside of my voice, more perspective. So
sure.
Yeah. Working on that pilot and then, yeah, just promoting things for Mina as much as I can from now until all through September.
What genre yeah. is the pilot, to the degree that it has a genre?
It is more drama with a little bit of comedy. It's almost like, I don't want to call it a dramedy because I'm like, I know The Bear is considered more of a drama than a comedy, but like, yeah, it's definitely more drama than comedy. So
I think people really struggle with the idea. I know it forced Woody Allen into making a handful of really terrible movies, aside from his movies that are terrible for very different reasons. But he was so afraid when he was coming out of comedy only into making dramas that he made three movies that were not, like, no one smiled. And there wasn't even a single funny moment. And I was like, dude, your hero Bergman never made a movie without a single funny moment. Like, the saddest times in your life will still be funny.
Yeah.
So this idea yeah. that a drama with five jokes in it is a comedy, it's like, no, man, that's just yeah. life, actually.
Yeah.
The
best dramas on television. I mean, you look at The Wire, you look at The Sopranos, yeah. you look at Breaking Bad, they're all hilarious. Like
yeah.
The Sopranos might be the funniest show I've ever seen in my life.
You know? Yeah, you need that break of that levity, you yeah. know, you need to yeah. break it up some way.
Yeah.
Yeah. yeah. It's just the strangest yeah. idea that a drama shouldn't also be. And it got me in trouble once. I was pitching something once that I thought was an hour-long action adventure thing, mm-hmm. an hour-long live action sci-fi action adventure thing. And I made the executives laugh too much. And when they stopped me at a certain point and they said, so this is like a 22-minute Adult Swim animated comedy, right? And I was like, oh no, not like,
oops.
I thought I was selling you the X-Files and you thought it somehow in your head it's the Venture Brothers. Oh shit. reminded myself that the next time I was like, the pitch is too funny. Don't emphasize how hilarious these characters are because they will kill it. And then of course I also went, you know, it's not, that could be a 22-minute animated film. That's an animated show. That's not impossible.
Like, what do you want?
Yeah. Often what you have to do is if they're rolling along with it and they seem to like it, you say, absolutely. That's exactly what it is.
Well, that's the thing. Ultimately, they weren't wrong in the sense that, yeah, I had made it pretty funny. And it was satirical and I could kind of see, and it was so visually fantastic. It was like, yeah, this probably is really freaking expensive for what I thought it was, which was like a sci-fi channel
yeah.
show when sci-fi was still making hour long shows like that. And I was like, no, they're actually probably right that Flash animation and great voice actors is the way to go with this thing.
Yeah.
But anyway, so where can people find you on the internet, Julie?
Well, you can find me, I'm on Blue Sky. I'm also on Instagram, and then I'm also on Threads. That's something that I've been also, I guess, divulging more of my time to. I'm not really on Twitter anymore. I just have my handle on it. But otherwise, yeah, Instagram and Blue Sky, Threads. And then if you want to check out my website, gingerrabbitstudio.com, that's where I'll be posting, you know, any comic book signings. If you're in the area, I really doubt a lot of the audience would be, but if anytime, I'm going back to LA, you know, I obviously, you know, put on socials that I'm like here, you could come and visit me. But yeah,
we're huge in Spain and Norway, so I don't see why we wouldn't be big in North Carolina also. So who knows?
That's true. That's true.
Yeah. Hi, North Carolinians. There you go. Yeah.
Cool. Nice. And Rylan, where can people find you on the?
I am at Rylan Grant on all forms of social media. That is RYLENDGRANT. If you are just listening, I have to spell it because it's not a real name. My parents just kind of drunkenly arranged letters and saddled me with it. And so now I have to spell it for everybody. But yeah, check out Haunted Heart. If you're in Spain, we have a lot of listeners in Spain, apparently. So it's out now if you're in Spain. It will be out end of September everywhere else, seemingly in the UK, in North America, theaters, and on some streaming platforms, depending on where you're at. So check that out. And as I said, check out the socials, because I have probably 2 days ago just made an announcement for the next Kickstarter book. Do a lot of Kickstarter evangelizing here today. So yeah, my next book, The Breach, it is a Black Mirror-esque sci-fi tale about a border war, a small Alaskan town that, you know, it borders Russia, but it also borders something else, something evil and mysterious.
Nice.
And what spills over those borders. But yeah, that is the pre-launch page should be up now. So you can go on over to Kickstarter.com and search The Breach, search my name. Go over to my socials and follow a link over there and follow along, sign up for notifications. That should launch on September 16th, I believe. That's the current plan. So, you know, let's hope that that sticks. But it's a great book. You're going to love it. Go check it out. Bring us home, Mr. Avalone.
I can be found at davidavalonefreelance.com. That links out to all the things. And in comic shops, Drawing Blood continues, and you should pick it up and read it because it's great. And if you have kids, or even if you don't, you should watch Batwheels on Max or on Netflix, because I write that.
Awesome.
So far, only one of my episodes has dropped so far, but I have three in the second season, and it's looking like two in the third, which animation takes so long. Who knows how long it'll be before the third season drops, when we're only 10 episodes into the 40 episode second season. So we'll see.
People are still getting paid to write in Hollywood. That's crazy.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. Not a lot, nice. Because animation, but yeah.
Yeah. It's sure. Yeah. There
you go. But anyway, Julie, thank you.
You
so
can
much
make more McDonald's in California now, but yeah, sorry.
Well, congrats, David. That's awesome. I love animated shows. I love animation, obviously. Thank you so much. Yeah.
It's a fun thing. And, you know, one of the ironies of me stepping away from screenwriting to get into comic book writing is the comic book writing led back to the best screenwriting jobs I've ever had. So, wah, a little bit of a joke there. But that's how the world works sometimes. Julie, thank you so much for joining us. This is a great talk.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks all of you for listening. And we'll see you on the next exciting episode.
Ciao.
Take it easy, guys. North Carolinians.
If you're watching us on YouTube, be sure to smash that like button. If you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts or other fine purveyors of ear crack, please leave us a 5-star review. And wherever you're watching and or listening, subscribe, subscribe, subscribe. We'll see you back here next week for more madcap hijinks on The Writer's Block.
For more information, visit pendantaudio.com. Thanks for listening.